So what I would like to do to begin our time together is to address something that came up this past week. It's been announced that, and so you're aware of the fact that I was getting, or at least I put it in the bulletin, I was getting my vaccine shot and was able to receive that shot, the first one, the Moderna vaccine, and hopefully in 28 days' time there will be enough vaccine left over where I can get the second one. And will help me with immunity against the virus. There's an article that I wrote in the bulletin that the large teaching article in the middle of it that deals somewhat with that idea of the vaccine and what it portends for the future and what we need to be thinking of as Christians with regard to its impact upon our abilities to get together and worship God. And I would like for you to read that. And for those who are at home or not able to be with us at this point in time, it's up on the website at soundteaching.org, and I would encourage you to go and read that as well. But having said that, at the same time, there was a missionary preacher, a dispensationalist preacher named Robert Breaker, that I came across on the internet that was dealing with the idea of the vaccine and the coronavirus and applying it to the mark of the beast in Revelation chapter 13. And I'm going to put the slide up so that you can see kind of what he was talking about a little bit. And we're going to address that just for a few moments. And I thought I would bring this up, even though it's a side thing, because it is indicative of the type of interpretations, the fanciful interpretations that are arrived at by so many religious people today. And he's a dispensationalist, which indicates that he is a premillennialist. And these different premillennial theories, but more especially the peculiar and bizarre ways in which they interpret the book of Revelation to justify their views of the end days and what's going to come, is something that it's funny almost in its absurdity, but it's very, very unfunny in the fact that so many are led astray as a result of these things. So I thought it might be a good thing for us to address. And so I want to spend just a few moments talking about that and making a few points before we get back into the regular part of our study. So first of all, Revelation 13 and verses 11 through 18, it's the beast of the earth that's under, or beast of the earth that's under consideration here. And I want you to notice especially verse 18. We're not going to discuss the teaching of this book to any great extent because we'll be addressing that in a later scene. But I want you to notice what it said. Here is wisdom. This is Revelation 13, 18. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number, calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. The number is 666. So everyone who's here has heard of the mark of the beast and the number of the beast, which is 666. It stated that the individuals all must have the mark either on their right hand or their forehead, and if you do not have it on your right hand or forehead, you would not be able to buy or sell. In other words, there would be no ability to engage in commerce. You would be, in effect, persecuted because you didn't have the mark of the beast. And the idea is, are you going to have the mark of the beast or the mark of God upon you? And that's the major point that we need to understand and occupy or acknowledge. This dispensationalist preacher named Robert Breaker, he preached a sermon on the subject, and he attributed the coronavirus with the mark of the beast. I want you to notice, first of all, what's up on the board, and that is the word corona, which is an English word that has been used to identify this kind of virus. The number of the letters, there are six letters, which supply the six. And if you do the numerical equivalent of each letter in the English alphabet, and you add those up, because the C is the third letter, the O is the 15th, the R is the 18th, on, you get the number 66 when those are added together. C, it's mark 666. So this idea of corona, it comes up to 666. Second thing that he noted is the claims regarding the technical name COVID-19 and what COVID-19 stands for. He didn't give his sources with regard to this, but he said the word COV means a certificate of vaccination. A certificate of vaccination. So here we're getting the mark itself. What is the mark going to be? A certificate of vaccination. The word ID means so that the individuals could be identifying all who have been vaccinated. Because if you have a certificate of vaccination and you're ID'd with that certificate of vaccination, then you can buy and sell. But if you don't have that certificate of vaccination, you're not ID'd as one who has that, then you could not. And the word 19, or the number 19, the one stands for A in the alphabet. 9 is I. AE is artificial intelligence, which would be what would be used to monitor those who are vaccinated. So that was his view of it, and how you need to. And the title of his sermon was Understanding the Times. So these are the times that we're in. This COVID thing has been probably manufactured, and it's for the express purpose of establishing this one world government and the domination of the people of God and so on and so forth. And this is the mark of the beast of the earth. It's what's under consideration in this. As he continued on in his lesson, believe me, I didn't listen to all of it. This all came in the first 8 minutes that he was talking, and that was about all that I could take. But he talked about Bill Gates, who is a large contributor to the World Health Organization, and who has talked about the possibility of getting a quantum dot tattoo, which would be an ink tattoo, very small, which might be the mark itself that would be made, and that Dr. Fauci is in favor of the mandatory certificates of vaccination so that we can determine who has been vaccinated and who has not been. So these are the contentions that he made. They are false claims. There is obvious information that Bill Gates never has indicated that there needs to be a quantum tattoo given to people injected in their arms when you inject the vaccine. And Fauci was talking about something entirely different than a mandatory certificate of vaccination for all men. So it's speculative, it's conspiracy theory, it's silliness regarding the meaning of the number 666 and what's coming on with the virus. But I want you to understand that these are things that have been common throughout the years. And I want to give you just a couple of examples. The first time this was ever brought up was with regard to Nero Caesar. And when you take the word Nero Caesar and you translate that from the Greek language to the Hebrew language, and I'm not sure why that would be done, but you also look at the variant spellings, which the variant spelling, and it's the secondary spelling of Nero, has an N on the end in the Hebrew, then again you get the number 666. If you don't include that variant spelling and you just go with Nero by itself instead of Neron, then it's only 616. But regardless, the number 666 is found from that. So Caesar is the beast. And then there was a man that I met, and my mom will remember him. He visited with us at the West 22nd Street congregation, actually West Ridge at that time, years and years ago when I was about 10 years old. He had a van, and on the side of the van, it had JFK, John F. Kennedy, 666. He thought that the Beatles were the four horses of the apocalypse, and had this idea that because John F. Kennedy had received a mortal wound, like the beast who had seven heads, and one said he had received a mortal wound and yet recovered, that John F. Kennedy actually recovered from his head wound, and that he was alive, and that he is the Antichrist on earth. This is a view that he had. Bizarre, ridiculous, but he was set in that view. And while he enjoyed singing with us, he wasn't able and willing to stay with us because he wouldn't come off the views that he had with regard to these things. Another one that I came across in my just short little bit of looking on the internet for other examples, Ronald Wilson Reagan, each name has six letters. And there were some who were advocating when he arose to the presidency that he was the beast of the earth because of his name. There's the mark of the beast, 666. And then finally, one that is going around and has been going around for a couple of decades now is the World Wide Web, because we all understand the conspiracy concerning technology and how they're trying to run things. And you cannot do business, buy or sell, without being on the internet now. But the www, when those W's are put in the Hebrew language, 666. So we get those kinds of things. And there, you can go out on the internet and you can find documentation and views like that that are found everywhere on the internet. And there's a lot of others, bizarre ones, that come up from time to time. So I just want you to understand that's one way of interpreting the book of Revelation. You take numbers literally. You look for ways in which the numbers or the symbols or the characters can be found in our culture today, because after all, it piques the interest and it thrills the imagination of all individuals to think that we are the ones that are living in the last days. We talked about Mark chapter 9 and verse 1. the promise that Jesus gave to some who were standing there at that time that they would not die until they saw the kingdom of God present with power, that we have been living in the last days for over 2,000 years. Well, people have the idea that there will be the reconstitution of the European Union. And when that happens, there will be the events which are transpiring in the book of Revelation that will come to pass. And this is the generation in which we're going to see the second coming of Christ. And generations have passed. The first time that that was mentioned was centuries and centuries ago. Premillennialism gained a foothold in America in the 19th century with regard to Jehovah's Witnesses and the Adventists. And then you had 1898 and then 1914. And then there has been date after date after date that has been given. Concept of the rapture was stated by, I forget his name, Hal Lindsey, 1970s. I have a book in my library called Countdown to Armageddon, the 1980s. Where Armageddon would take place in that decade because of the rise of the Soviet Union and the Cold War. These kinds of speculative, literal translations of the book of Revelation, they pique the interest of people. When you think about a movie or a movie series about the end times, you don't find something that coincides with what we believe the Bible teaches, what the Bible in truth teaches about the last days and the coming of the Lord. What you have are books about raptures and the Tim LaHaye Left Behind series, and a movie was made from that had a theatrical release. Those are the kinds of things that you get because that's exciting. That's the devil sending his demons and battles with blood and the battle of Armageddon being this physical conflict between Jesus and the men of earth, and it's going to just be a horrible, horrible, horrific thing, and we need to be on the side of Jesus, or when he sends the rapture to where people will return to him, we'll be left behind. And these are the kinds of things that people get excited about. Well, we don't have time to debunk them today, and that's not my purpose at all, but I do want to just note a couple of things so that you can rest assured that this isn't so. First of all, there are seven different coronaviruses. This is not the first time that we've had a coronavirus. In fact, the common cold is a coronavirus. There are seven of them. There are more than that, but there are seven of them that affect and infect humans that have been discovered. Secondly, the naming of the virus is far different than what this man in the crazy websites where he got his information claim. The word CO stands for coronavirus. The VI stands for virus. So coronavirus, the D stands for disease, coronavirus disease, and it is -19 because it was discovered in 2019 as its origination in Wuhan, China. So that's the reason for the naming of that name. And actually, the technical name is a little bit different from that, but it still has some of those components. The third thing we want to note is it'd be silly to think that the only way a book that is written in Greek can be understood is to ascribe an interpretation that uses the English language. You know, Mark of the Beast is corona because this word corona, the word corona, though the coronavirus is called that in every nation, the fact is that's an English word, not a Greek word. And even when you go with Nero Caesar, they don't go with the English, which the New Testament is written in and which the book of Revelation is written in. You got to take that to the Hebrew in order to get those numbers to add up to 666. So it's silly to think that that would be the case. Why is it called a coronavirus? It's a very simple thing. You can see it by looking. A corona is a part of the body that looks like a crown or the gaseous envelope of the sun and other stars. When you look under a electron microscope at a coronavirus, that's about the only way you can see it because of how small it is. It looks like it has a corona surrounding it. That's the stalks that go out around the virus body. That's why it's called a coronavirus. Fourthly, let us notice this. Context. These are things, as Revelation 1 verses 1 through 3 tells us, which must shortly take place. Verse 3 of the text, keep the things that are written in it, for the time is near. So as you go down through these kinds of interpretations, it's not referencing the struggle between Catholicism and Muslims during the Crusades. It's not referencing World War I, which some said that's the end days. This is the world to end all war. I mean, the war to end all wars, which is what World War I was famously known by. Not referencing World War II. And in the book of Revelation, you do not have any idea that Adolf Hitler is one of these beasts that are coming. or the Antichrist. It's not referencing the Cold War, as we mentioned before, how Lindsay would have you to believe, with the Soviet Union. It's not referencing Social Security numbers or identification chips that are put under the skin, or the European Union. And all those kinds of things are misguided speculations, been disproven again and again and again. The failure of the previous speculations, where everyone said, this is what it means, and then turns out that's not what it meant. I had one article that I read concerning Hal Lindsey when the 80s came and passed, and Reagan and his government, in the midst of all of that the Soviet Union fell. He began to say that the Soviet Union will be reconstituted at some point in time. And so they have to make changes in their thinking, and they have to say, well, it didn't happen here because of this, but you can still use that, and you can apply it, and you can adapt it, and it will happen. And they keep going back to those things because all they are doing is speculating. They're guessing. They're guessing about things of which they have no knowledge, because the premise upon which they begin their guesses is inaccurate and wrong, which is why it's so important to be careful with regard to speculation when we look at the book. So why do they happen all the time? They're constant because they convince people. Because people are naive, they're credulous, they're ignorant. These conspiracy theories trouble so many, and by the way, trouble Christians as well, because of that naivety, because of that credulous nature that we have. And I want to say this, because I think it's an important thing to note. It's a sign of a person who is credulous, naive, and spiritually immature to take at face value any view. And now we're casting a broad net here, because it's really important. So what happens? And I'll just give you an example of many Christians that I've come across in social media who have forwarded what we would say as false information or conspiracy theories. Why do they forward those things? I had one Christian, as an example, who forwarded a picture of Barack Obama when he was president kissing amorously the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and said, see, we've got an immoral man in the presidency, and this is why we have to fight against it. Now, I don't have any qualms with saying that you could oppose Obama and his agenda, but that was a false picture. It was a picture of Obama kissing his wife, and the Prime Minister kissing Trudeau, kissing his wife, and they took the wives out and put them together, and it looks right, but it's fake. But why would an individual say, ooh, look at that, that's horrible, and pass it on? Because they're credulous, because they're naive, because they're ignorant, and they're not willing to take the time, or not taking the time, to make sure that something like that is actually so and true before they share it with other individuals. And in fact, what they're doing is sharing lies. There have been a number of times when I have talked to friends of mine who have shared something that is a lie, it is a false. And I will say to them, that's false, privately, in a message. I'll say, you need to acknowledge, or I've done it a couple of times publicly, you need to acknowledge that this is actually not so. And I will send the link of documentation showing how it's not so. And what do? They thank me. Stan, thank you, because I would never want to share anything that is untrue. And I think to myself, well, it took me 5 seconds to determine whether it was true or not by doing a Google search. Why would you send something that might be false, obviously might be false, without taking the time to assure that what you're doing is not true? It's not a hard thing to do. If anybody needs help in doing that, just let me know. I'll take you through Google search and Snopes.com and a few other things that you can go to. And you can look to see whether there's any validity to it. But understand this, that kind of naivety is indicative of spiritual immaturity. And it's done all the time. And we need to be careful about these things. Because we can be guilty of sharing lies. We can be guilty of having our minds polluted with things that are untrue, and making decisions that may impact our spiritual standing with God based upon naivety. Children tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. So what about the noble, mature attitude in regard to that? It's a sign of nobility to research claims, reject false and erroneous information, whether it be of a secular nature, in the example that we've given, most especially and most problematically with regard to doctrinal issues. Remember the nobility of the Bereans in Acts chapter 17. These were apostles that came to them disseminating this material. And we are told they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Now, I'm not saying that that's something that you weren't aware of, that you should out of hand reject it. Receive it, look at it, and determine whether it is actually so. If it's not, then you reject it. If it's so, you accept it. That's what God expects of us. In every aspect of our life, the impact is not only with regard to doctrine, but with regard to other things. These people come up with these speculative ideas, and they're easily debunked if you just think about it a little bit, or ask someone about it, or do a little bit of research. And these are important things for us to consider. So I thought that this was an example that would be helpful to us to kind of recenter ourselves as to why we're interpreting the book the way we are, why we are being careful, why we are seeking to avoid dogmatism when we cannot know for a certainty a meaning or an idea, and keep all those things in mind. The fifth and final point that I want to make is that this is the problem that is made primarily, we've alluded to it, you can't make symbolic language literal. So let's think about the number 666. The text actually already defines what the number 666 is. It is the mark of a man. We've already talked about symbols. What is the number 7 a mark of? Perfection, so attributed to God. So a mark of the divine. If you have God as 7, then man is going to be 6. Because God is perfect, man is imperfect. God is complete, man is incomplete. And so the number of a man is 666. The divine is from above, perfect. The human is from below and is imperfect. The conflict that we find in the entire book of Revelation is God versus Satan, good versus evil, the divine versus sinful mankind. And so I'd like to leave you with just one point concerning Genesis 13. We'll revisit later. It's Robert Harkrider's conclusion, which this quote is really good, to Revelation 13. We'll study it in more detail later. He says, the number 6 is a stand-in number for man, just as the number 7 exclusively represents God. Any occasion where man is in conflict with God, man will fail. Therefore, the wisdom referred to in this text is that all who stand with God shall win, but possessors of the mark of the beast shall see failure upon failure upon failure. 666. All right? So, that's the way in which we are interpreting the book of Revelation, a very conservative way that removes the concept of speculation, that keeps it within the context of the day, and helps us to avoid going off just completely ridiculous tangents and ideas that have absolutely no merit whatsoever. All right, so I wanted to spend a little time doing that. I thought it was an interesting thing at first, and at least you get to see kind of how bizarre it is. Makes you wonder why anybody would believe such a thing. But this viewing, and when we talk about the sermons that I put up on Facebook, you know, if I'm lucky, we'll get 600 views. And when you say 600 views, basically you mean that people slowed down long enough for it to start playing. They may have only viewed 1 or 2 seconds before they went on. And so people actually watching the whole thing, maybe 15 or 20, if we're really lucky. Had been shared, and the site that it was shared to, it had been viewed for over 17,000 times. And that's not to say what the original video had been shared, what the amount it had been shared. So we may talk about 30, 40, 50, 60,000, 100,000 people that are looking at this particular guy and saying, ooh, that could be. Maybe that's what's going on with this virus. So it piques the interest of the public. And the reason why it does is because it's bizarre. But we need to recognize error and to acknowledge why that error is something that is attractive to individuals and try to combat it with truth. You shall know the truth. Truth shall set you free, and truth need not fear investigation and examination. Okay, so that's my preaching done for the day. Well, not for the day, but for the class. So does anyone have any questions that they want to, or comments they want to make about this before we get back into the text? All right, then let us go back to Revelation chapter 6. And we talked in our study last week about the first seal that is found in verses 1 and 2. We began talking a little bit about the second seal with regard to the conflict on earth. And again, we have different views as to what the white horse refers to, and the one who sat upon it, who had a crown, was given to him, a bow, he went out conquering and to conquer. The contention that I made in my study, which kind of coincides with the second seal in my discussion and description of it, is that that would have reference to the coming of Christ, and the conquering, using Revelation 19:11 as a passage which would coordinate with that. Which, the point that I made when we talk about the second seal, he opened up the second seal, verse 3. I heard the second living creature say, "Come and see," and another horse that was fiery red that went out, and power was given to him who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. So the point that I made is that whenever the gospel is proclaimed, going up conquering with the gospel of Jesus Christ, then ultimately when that happens, then whenever there is the proclamation of the gospel, there are souls coming to Christ, immediately following that, there is persecution that comes. And so that the second horse here would have reference to the persecution of God's people. A couple of things to point out with regard to it. The second horse is red, and the word red, we already talked once about how red is indicative of God's judgment when you had the jasper and the Sardius stone being a blood red or a dark red stone in the throne room scene. Red is also something that is associated with the concept of slaughter or war, obvious because of blood. And so the idea of slaughter or war. Secondly, with regard to the great sword that was given in chapter 6 and verse 4, chapter 6 and verse 4, is a word that is referencing a short sword that was used. The word is Makaira. And that was the kind of sword that would be used in beheadings, in executions, in those kinds of things. Whereas the other sword that commonly is used, you'll notice going down to chapter 6 and verse 8, on the pale horse, there was there power to kill with sword, with hunger. That's a different word for sword. That is a big, long military sword that is used to describe the kind of sword that would be used in warfare. So, is there significance in those things? They are two different swords, two different words for sword that is used. And it seems that this one would fly with that concept more of an individual who sat on it, take peace from the earth, they should kill one another with regard to persecution. We looked at a couple of passages in our discussion last week concerning brother delivering up brother to death, the father his child, for the sake of Christ, Matthew 10:21. A little bit later in that text, verse 34, "I did not come to bring peace on earth. I came to bring a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his whole household." So that persecution is something that obviously follows. The only thing I would add to that is that we look at secular history to corroborate these things happening. And there are any number of examples that we could make note of. If you've never read Fox's Book of Martyrs, it is interesting. Now, the martyrdom is something, there's a lot of tradition. A lot of it comes from Catholicism. A lot of it is in later centuries. But even early on, there are evidences with regard to these kinds of persecutions, that they were killed with swords and knives, mauled by wild animals, burned alive at the stake, nailed to crosses, and thrown into boiling oil. These are things that happened to Christians in the first century. In fact, if I remember correctly, I got that list directly from the traditional list of what happened to the apostles. When you look at individual examples coming down through history as to what happened and what was characteristic of the time and what is believed to have happened to them. Not saying that that happened specifically, because we don't know that for certainty. But persecution would be something that would certainly be applicable or could be used to explain the symbol of the red horse. And we've talked about that again. I just wanted to kind of go over it quickly because I didn't have time to do it in detail. It was at the end of our class last time. Anybody have comments, questions about that second symbol, the second seal? All right, so that gets us to new material for sure in verses 5 and following, the third seal. When you open the third seal, "I heard a third living creature saying, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a black horse. He who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. I heard a voice from the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A measure of wheat for a denarius, and three measures of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine.'" Okay, what does that saying mean? Well, a couple of things to note. First of all, a denarius. A denarius was approximately one day's wage. Okay, so we're talking economics here. Keep in mind the concept of economics. So it would take a full day's wage for a measure of wheat. So let's say, okay, it takes all of your money for one helping of wheat. A denarius for three measures of barley. So we're talking about the scarcity or the economic deprivation that comes with regard to a lack or a scarcity of essentials. The lack of ability for individuals to basically make ends meet is what's under consideration here. So the word black and the black horse. We mentioned that it's difficult for us to ascertain too much about the horses other than the fact that they were different colors. Black, what does it portray generally? I think we can kind of have some intimate. Night, for example. Darkness. We wear black when we are mourning and in grief. It's something that was commonly the case. It's the opposite of white. So Haley, in utilizing this particular view that the third seal has reference to, commonly it's referred to either as famine or scarcity, deprivation, that this would be mourning or an idea of harshness and hardness, that it portrays grief and mourning. There's no light there. That's something that has a scriptural precedent. Certainly Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 27 and 28. The prophet Jeremiah concerning God's judgment of Israel for her evil. Thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be desolate, yet I will not make it a full end. For this shall the earth mourn and the heavens above be black. For I have spoken, I have purposed, and will not relent, nor will I turn back from it. The idea of God's judgment coming, or the idea of difficulty and tribulation and trial, the concept of blackness as a time of grief is something that is commonly known and understood. So, the he who sat. Famine is what's been stated time and again. I think that it's important, though, that we make a point in this regard. Does it signify famine? Okay, so you remember what happened with regard to Joseph in Egypt, that he became second in command to Pharaoh himself, that he had made provisions so that people could be fed during times of famine. And so not only did this allow for people to receive grain and barley whenever it was necessary for them to eat, but it also enriched the Pharaoh because he had the food. And so he could dole out that food and charge for that food. And it made Pharaoh richer as a result of those things. So when we talk about this, whenever there is scarcity, price goes up, doesn't it? When you have plenty, price goes down. So there's scarcity here. The interesting thing about it, when he talks about the scarcity, he makes mention of the measure of wheat, a measure of wheat for a denarius, three measures of barley for a denarius. But then that last phrase, it says, do not harm the oil and the wine. Can someone tell me what would be the distinction between wheat and barley and then oil and wine? How would they differ in category? Yes, Rick.
Some have postulated that it's necessity versus luxury.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of the idea that we get forward, that you don't have to have wine, you have to have wheat. I mean, you have water with your bread, but you don't have to have wine. And so that's one possibility that's under consideration here. At the very least, when it says, do not harm the oil and wine, there would be that indication that the scarcity was not over everything. And so famine might not be the best word to use, because there is plenty of oil and wine, but the idea of scarcity on earth, that there would be some kind of economic deprivation that would come as a result of the black horse riding out in the opening of the seal and what is accomplished or allowed to be accomplished through the efforts of the rider on the black horse. Rick, did you want something to add to it?
Well, I was going to say that it doesn't necessarily fit because you need oil to make bread with wheat. So you either use water or oil, but those are the things used to make bread.
Yeah. Do you have another idea as to what might be signified by that?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I think at the very least, what we can see is that typically whenever there are famines and scarcity, it doesn't affect everyone. It affects the poor. It affects those who are oppressed. And so perhaps that's as far as we should go with regard to that. Just again to use Haley, since I mentioned him at the first, he says this: the ride of the black horse therefore symbolizes grief, woe, and mourning. The lot of persecuted saints who follow the preaching of the gospel. And the idea would be this scarcity or deprivation that is visited upon them. We'll talk a little bit more about that with regard to the pair of scales. Questions, comments about the he who sat or the black horse itself? Notice then in verse 6, the latter part of verse 5, he who sat on it had a pair of scales. Okay, what do you do with scales? Measure out, right? We've got a pair of scales right under our television in our living room that never gets used. But it's an interesting thing, the way they used to do it. It has three weights. I don't know if they're ounce weights or gram weights or whatever, a big one, a medium one, and a small one. And so if you want to get hard candy in olden days, and you want, 4 ounces of hard candy, you'd put the 4 ounce weight on one side of the scale, and you put candy in one piece at a time until, I don't know how many ounces you can get of candy for 4 ounces, but till it would balance out. So the measuring out of the scale. So this idea of the scale and the rider having that scale, and the idea of the barley and the wheat and the measuring out, again, would be something that would indicate the purpose of the rider is to mete out this, to bring this forth. And so the pair of scales, it's a means of measuring out. The penny was a full day's wage, or denarius was a full day's wage. So I want you to just kind of think about that. A Christian who's because of his circumstance, because of persecution. We talked previously in our letters to the churches of Asia about economic deprivation that would come to some church because of the trade guilds in the city. You remember that the trade guilds controlled things. They had these big feasts and you had to participate. You had to be a part of the guild and you had to participate in their feasts and their rituals and those kinds of things. If you could not do that because they were pagan, then you were not included and it made it more difficult for you. And so if you're a Christian during this time, one of the ways in which persecution would come would be through economic deprivation, not only through persecution or other things. And so this idea would be the economic deprivation that would come. Christians who were unwilling to worship the emperor, unwilling to engage in evil practices of the trade guilds, they would be removed from their jobs or could only have jobs that didn't pay much, or they would be individuals who would be forced to accept lower wages as a result of it. And this would be a test to all Christians. You can reject the faith and enjoy the privileges of being a part of this group that has the money or that's giving out the money, or else you could serve God and as a result of that be deprived. So the persecution, of course, that we suffer today too from time to time can be related in the same way, that it can be economic as a result of our standing, the fact that we cannot participate or will not participate in things that others do. All right, so that's all that I have with regard to the black. In regard to the symbols and the third seal. Anybody have any comments, questions? Go on. Okay, let's just very quickly go as far as we can with it. The fourth one is the one that Johnny Cash made famous, and that is the fourth seal open. I heard the voice of the four living creatures saying, "Come and see." Verse 8, I looked, behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him, or Hell followed with him. Power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. So we have the identification. That helps us with any ability. Pale horse, the one who rode upon it was Death. Pale. One description that I came across was a sickly, gruesome color symbolic of disease and death. And when you look at the death, in the way in which death comes in verse 8 of the text, it's something that seems to be an indication of those things that are common to man. So we could say that Christians would not only be persecuted and slaughtered sometimes, in other words, put to death for their faith, not only would they be deprived, but there are other things that would come as a result of that, things that will continue until Christ comes again. All the fleshly troubles that we experience, warfare, famine, disease, or beast. You'll remember we mentioned the fourth of the earth, killed with the sword. That's the war sword, if we make that distinction. Hunger. How many in our world die of starvation or suffer with starvation? with death or disease just comes as the lot of all men. And even by beasts of the earth, where you have individuals who fall upon unfortunate circumstances or killed either accidentally or because of interactions. I don't think as many people today die from beasts, but that doesn't mean that it cannot happen. And so that idea is the concept of death. The fourth one is death. Death is the lot of all men and will be the lot of all men until Christ comes again. But death is the final enemy that is destroyed. And in the end, when Christ comes, we will be raised from the dead to be with him forever in the air. So this mentions specifically a quarter of the earth. That's 25% of the earth. You think about that in addition to the persecution and the economic depravity or scarcity that Christians would suffer. You add these up and it's a woeful picture that you have with regard to the opening of these seals. And it doesn't surprise us that a little bit later on in the chapter, the cries of the martyrs would say, how long? How long? How long is this going to continue? Because it is a time of difficulty and trouble. The only other thing I would add to that, and then we'll draw the lesson to a close, we can ask for questions next or other comments next week, is Hades. It's translated hell in the King James Version. That's typical for the King James. The word is Hades. It is not hell. Hades has reference to the realm of those who are dead. Remember Matthew 16. This is an important thing. When Christ told Peter, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. None of these things will ultimately prevail against God and against his church. So though Hades is the present reality of those who die, it has no lasting power because of the resurrection, when all will rise to meet him in the air. 1 Corinthians 15, you can look at that. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians about the ultimate resurrection from the dead, the ascendance to heaven to be at the right hand of the Father. All right, that's it. Anybody have any comments, questions before the bell rings? Yes, Rick. Overlying message is we prevail. We win. That's our victory is in Christ. And ultimately, God wins, so if we're his, we win as well. All right. I appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. If you do have something to say about the third seal, you can bring it up next week, and otherwise we'll get into the fourth seal next week, and we'll get on into the fifth seal, which is a change of scene. Thank you very much for coming today.